Welcome to Conversations with Alan Wolper, a half-hour audio biography featuring unique personalities whose lives and ideas are on the cutting edge. Alan Wolper is an award-winning journalist and a professor at Rutgers University Newark. And now, here's Conversations with Alan Wolper.
If you're in New York City or Philadelphia, you might come upon a group of men cleaning streets in crisp blue uniforms with an American flag on their sleeves and the words ready, willing, and able on their backs. These men were part of the growing army of the former homeless, the ex-drug dealers and addicts, military veterans, convicted criminals, all desperate for a place to live and a job to support them. They're trainees of the Doe Fund, a nonprofit organization run by George McDonald and his wife, Harriet Carr McDonald, a project that started in the terminal at Grand Central Station, where they fell in love and made a lifelong commitment to each other and helping the homeless become functional members of society. Welcome.
Thank you.
So tell us the story. George, you're first.
I started feeding homeless people in the Grand Central Terminal in 1984, 1985, after a woman had died of malnutrition. And she literally starved to death in the center of the richest city in the richest country in the world. And I went there to investigate how that could happen.
She died on Christmas Day, didn't she? Well, she was found on Christmas Day.
Well, that was the Mama Doe. That was on my ticket a year later. I first went there because a woman died, and I wanted to know why. And so I went and I talked to the police, and I talked to the shopkeepers, and I discovered this community of people that actually lived in Grand Central Terminal. That was a shock to me as a New Yorker in those days. It wasn't very common, but it had started and built up. And so then I got a friend of mine and we raised some money and we bought food from the Board of Education and started giving it out at 10 o'clock at night.
Good sandwiches.
And they were, the people thought that they were good. They weren't very nutritious, I'm afraid, in hindsight. Bologna and cheese with mayonnaise. But there was an apple and milk and, and we'd do that every night at 10 o'clock. And then I'd carry the food inside and we'd feed 200-300 people inside of the terminal. And Mama was one of the women who we would feed. And she lay down on Christmas Eve and was sick. And instead of they closed the terminal at 1 o'clock, and instead of calling an ambulance for her, they threw her out on the street, and she came back in the morning on Christmas Day and lay down on the bench and died right there of pneumonia, eminently preventable, and so we named the Doe Fund after her, and we've been going back every Christmas Day.
It's sort of like the John Doe, because no one knew her real name, right?
That's it, and we still don't know her name. And
you identified her with the morgue, did you not?
I did. And we go back every Christmas since then.
What did you do with her body after you?
We buried her in Queens.
Not at one of those places where nobody knows who she is.
No, she's in a Catholic cemetery in Queens, with a headstone. Home at last.
Harriet?
I came to this in a very different way. I was a screenwriter living in Beverly Hills, and I was hired to write a screenplay about a real young girl who was a throwaway living in Grand Central. And I spent over a week with her, going on crack. She was using crack. I went with her on buys, and I came to know a lot of the people in Grand Central. At the end of it, I decided she was quite extraordinary. She was a little crazy and a crack addict, but
brilliant.
Brilliant. So I decided I would take her back to Beverly Hills. I'd put her in drug treatment.
And how old was she?
She was about 17, but she had lived there a long time. She had been abandoned there.
Yeah, I knew her.
And George knew her, but I didn't know George. And I decided I would adopt her and bring her home with me and raise her with my daughter because she hadn't gone to school. And she got afraid and she hid from me at the end to change her life. And right after the first draft, I got a call that she had killed herself.
With a stolen gun.
With a stolen gun that she had tried to sell all day for crack money. And I came to her funeral. I'm Jewish. And this priest gave this amazing eulogy about how she was a shining star in the night sky. And afterward, in typical Hollywood fashion, I went up to the priest and said, I have the rights. And he said, the rights to what? And I said, to April's story.
April Servino.
Servino. And we decided to meet afterwards for a drink at the Lion's Head in the Village. And I'm crying.
Of all places. A lot of people probably don't even know that's the biggest hangout for New York writers during the 60s and 70s.
And politicians.
And politicians. Well, you ran for governor, you would know that. You ran for mayor.
So I'm weeping because I'm devastated. And this priest is rubbing my leg. And I think, all these things you hear about priests are really true. This is horrifying. But of course, he wasn't a priest. He only gave the eulogy. And he was, in fact, a homeless advocate. And that was George.
My goodness, listen to what we have here. We have a confessional, huh?
Well, you know, it turned out that, you know, Harriet was from Beverly Hills and I was from New York, and that started my life over again trying to do good. And the both of us had the same values and the same desire. So, you know, it was a match made in heaven, that's for sure.
People have seen all these guys on the street in blue. And I wonder how many of them are afraid of them. There seems to be a movement in the country that never goes away, and that is, if they're homeless, they're dangerous.
Well, I don't know. Maybe if they're black, they're dangerous.
I think that's more like it. What people think.
It's racial.
Sure.
Absolutely. Oh. I mean, the man. Yeah.
Why is it? Is it more today because of what's happening around the country?
Of course. It's never changed. We've gone from slavery to mass incarceration. We devalue African-American lives. They've never been valued at it. You talk about a glass ceiling for women, and that's true. But beyond that, we've always viewed African-Americans as if they weren't worth employing. And if you did, they should be at the lowest possible wage. And they're not worth educating, or we would educate them. They wouldn't have all these displaced youth that aren't going to school and that aren't employed and that are out on the street corners.
And you're helping them though.
Well,
tell us a little bit. Tell us a little bit about this program of yours. Either one of you.
Okay.
Harriet.
So we started with the belief, because of our knowledge of the people themselves, that what they needed was an opportunity. Obviously, there are mentally ill people, and there are people with physical disabilities and people with AIDS that are homeless. But based on our now very long experience...
30 years.
30 years. There is a vast population of people who want to help themselves that need an opportunity.
And that's called work,
and
paid transitional work. So right from the very beginning, we have paid above the minimum wage for our folks to go to work every day.
And you get
they
them a place,
like to go to work.
Give
they,
them a place to live.
And a place to live. They want
we
to go to work.
We house 1,000 people at a time.
And what they're looking for most is a paycheck, is money in their pocket. That's what they're looking for.
But they
have criminal records, you know, since every one of them just about in America has been incarcerated at some point.
You seem pretty angry, George.
Well, I mean, how long can we go on like this? They're shooting down these kids across America when we should be offering them opportunity.
Well, tell us more about the opportunity that you're offering them, Harry.
So this is a very comprehensive program. People come, they live with us, and I must tell you, beautiful facilities. And that's possible because of the support of individuals in the community. They go to work every day, but they have a lot of services. We do anger management. We do education, computer training. And after people clean the streets, they pick a track and we educate them. For example, we run our own pest control company. And we get all of these guys.
That company belongs to you guys?
Yes. Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Thank you for telling me.
So we run businesses that prepare people for jobs in the private sector.
And generate revenue at the same time that they get paid with.
You're listening to Conversations with Alan Wolper on WBGO 88.3 FM and WBGO.org. Our guests, as you've been listening, are George McDonald and his wife, Harriet Carr McDonald. Co-founders? Well, co-founders, really. You were first, but you were really close to second, yeah. A nonprofit organization that strives to give the homeless a new lease on life. Listen, I'd like our audience to hear some of those stories.
I have become part of the less, the hopeless, the helpless, the jobless, the hapless. Anything that was, I was less. But I had gotten acceptance that I was going to die a horrific death in an abandoned building. And that was okay. I thought that would be the best thing for everybody. My suffering would end. I would no longer be a parasite tugging away at society, and my mother could stop worrying about me.
I was on drugs for 17 years. I didn't have no direction. I didn't have no guidance.
I was 19 going on 20 when I went to prison. For 32 years, I was incarcerated in New York State Corrections. I was like in a cage, watching the world turn as I sat dormant.
I was struck by a story I read in one of the papers. I'm not sure where it still works, where a couple, again, I'm just looking at their names, are Nicholas and Toy Joplin. You remember that name? She said that her husband had 72 arrests and 43 convictions. You have people like that all the time?
I remember one 49 arrests, right?
Yes.
And he was out for, he didn't do anything for, I don't know, 20 years.
Yeah.
20 years. And then he committed another crime after 20 years. But he had 49 arrests before that and came to us, and he was straight for 20 years.
One of the things I noticed that your program is about 9 months to a year, is that correct?
Yes.
And if they, these guys live in places for a while, and you try to get them home, and if they miss something, or they miss a meeting, or they miss jobs, they get evicted?
No.
No?
Absolutely not.
That was in one of the papers, one of the news organizations.
Huh? It's not true. It's the opposite.
Don't believe everything you're reading in there.
That's why I'm asking.
Yeah. No. The reality of our program and the way that it's constructed is the people we serve basically have no family. Right, they've burned the bridges or they never had one to begin with. And from the beginning, George and I were like the mom and dad. And
now I'm more like the grandfather.
And we tell people when they graduate, if you hit a bump in the road, or even when they leave, because they're using...
Come back to us.
They all come back.
Because we have an investment. It's like what Mike Bloomberg used to say. You know, when he'd ask me how I was, and I'd say, thanks for asking, Mayor. And he'd say, well, I really am asking because I have so much invested in you.
The graduation ceremony, I noticed where people are throwing their hats in the air, sort of like the military academy or Yale or Harvard, anywhere else.
Yes.
Is that you do that on purpose?
Absolutely. Yes. Because our people have... very few things in their life that show that they completed something. And it's very important to them and also to their families and their children.
Right, and they show up.
And they come. The children come.
Now we don't wait for people...
The guy's children. These men have children.
Oh, they all have children.
They all have children.
All of them.
Yeah, 70%.
Yeah. I mean, a vast majority. And they're starting a new life.
And they're fathers, their mothers, not their fathers so much, but their mothers and their sisters and their, you know, cousins. And
their children.
We do it at St. Ignatius Loyola on 84th Street and Park Avenue in the undercroft of the church. And the fire department comes and says that we have too many people. We have a thousand people.
You know, I was talking to somebody about this, and they said that
a lot of these men who are the first 3 months when they're out on the streets and they're cleaning up, that they become babysitters as well. They're sort of trusted.
Yes,
I think totally. The trust has something
it's
to do with it.
Unbelievable.
Well, you know, that's the beautiful thing about this. The vast majority of the people we serve have almost never been out of right. the poorest communities. I got a call maybe a year ago from a young gentleman in the program, and he said, "Oh, Miss Harriet, I'm in Midtown Manhattan. Do you know there really are huge buildings here? And there are people on the street that speak different languages."
East New York, that, Brooklyn. That's right. where he was from.
That's how
never been to
isolating
Manhattan.
Poverty is. They don't get out of our poorest neighborhoods.
They're excluded from society.
They're excluded. And they feel so unworthy.
But the wonderful thing is that what it unleashes in them when they're trusted and patted on the back.
And the community thanks them.
It's fantastic, you see, because they're no different than anybody else.
Do you watch them in the street?
Of course.
Oh, we have a hierarchy.
No, I'm talking about you two guys.
Of course. Yeah. We've been talking to them on the street always.
So here's a great one. I ran into a guy on 3rd Avenue who just got out of 15 years in prison for selling cocaine. I said, "Well, you know, where were you doing that? What was that?" He said, "I'm Wall Street."
Actually, on Wall Street, the way things are going these days, nothing ever happens to you after you do something that's not quite as
exactly.
Point exactly.
But this guy, yes.
We have
not them.
I was talking to one of the people who worked for you, Alexander Horowitz, and he mentioned that there were organizations of that you had helped start in Colorado and Atlanta, and D.C. That indicates to me that the homeless population is just growing exponentially.
Oh, it's been here the whole time that we have. It's been all across America since we started. There's no doubt about that. When I met Harriet and went to Los Angeles, I was on the beach with the, you know, fighting back helicopters that were coming down, trying to put out the fire, the cans that the homeless people on the beach were keeping themselves warm with. We led demonstrations there.
He came. We started leading demonstrations
in Los Angeles, but there were many, many homeless people, and there they had families living outside by the railroad track because it's so warm.
How do police react to this?
Police react to
homelessness.
It's changed.
From what to what?
I don't know that it's...
What do you mean it's changed?
That it's changed. I think it's been pretty consistent.
Which is?
Well, it may have changed in New York recently. Is that
what
you're talking about?
That's what I'm talking about.
Okay, that's true. But typically...
What do you mean? What
they're not social workers.
What it changed from what to what? The police are not social workers and they used to be?
Heretofore, the police would ask people to move along and go to the shelter in New York City. They're not engaged in that so much these days.
Why not?
I guess you'd have to ask them.
I'm sure you've asked them.
Well,
you're kind of emotional about this, both of you, so I assume that you talk to police commissioners and police officers.
The commissioner's reaction to the homeless people on the street was not to give them money. So I guess he's blaming the public. No, he was blaming
the public
specifically.
He actually said that if the voters were so concerned about homelessness, they shouldn't give the people
in New York City. There are a lot more homeless people visible out on the street than there were 2 years ago.
Well, basically, there's been an incredible increase in the amount of luxury housing, and the people who are losing their homes very often are the population that you guys are working with. Am I right? Kicked out of homes. That's the evictions.
Well, they're really the places where they're from. In the Bronx, there's not luxury housing, and East New York, Brooklyn, and the places where they really actually are from, and that they go to prison from, and come home from prison too.
I think
not 57th Street or 59th Street or the Upper West Side. Well, I agree with you that we've kind of overdeveloped here when you look at the skyline.
If you could see the skyline.
If you could see the skyline. And we need a greater equity of our resources.
Well, I think that people are more concerned about what happens in the streets than they've ever had before because they've invested so much money in the city.
That's that could be too. That could be too.
And there is. I mean,
and
there
the pressure from people who have money would seem to be a lot heavier than the ones who don't.
That's always the case.
Well, exactly.
So, what are you going to do to change the perception that lives in New York and across the country? What are you guys doing? Tell us about it. So, George runs for mayor, and people get upset listening to him tell these terrible stories.
I think that because of our really extraordinary and documented data, hard data success, we have become
which is.
What we do, which no one else did, and we started this way because we came from very different backgrounds than social services, we believed that we were going to do this work, and while everyone had great anecdotes, we wanted to be informed
by the data
of success rates in many areas.
We were going to do something else if it didn't work.
But our belief was that if you give people opportunity to support themselves, that's what they want.
So here's the latest, our latest ability to attempt influence the national debate and discussion and lead. The Department of Labor and Justice came out with a RFP, a request for people to come forward with programs that would show the best practices for people coming home from prison. And what happens to them after that?
And I'll let you tell a little bit about it until I tell everybody else who you are and why you're here. I'm Alan Walper, and you're tuned in to Conversations with Alan Walper on WBGO 88.3 FM and WBGO.org. And you've been listening to the stories of the streets, actually, and the attempts to get them off the streets of George McDonald and Harriet McDonald, co-founders and co-directors and the people who run the Doe Fund. The world is changing, and city governments don't see as sympathetic to the homeless as they used to be, is what I was saying before, and you're telling me maybe they are. From Washington?
So this one, we were chosen as one of six in America, and we went through the process that they wanted us to, which was to serve 500 people over the course of a two-year period and send 500 people to other providers. And they do what scientifically is called random assignment. There's no better measure of how a program works. So this is the federal government asking for reentry programs, and thousands applied. We were one of six. And then now we are done, and they are about to announce the results.
I want to ask you something. A lot of the return, that struck a nerve with me, because a lot of the people that you deal with are diverse, and they're called military veterans from Iraq, from Afghanistan. They're white. They're poor, they're sometimes patriotic, and they come back pieces of themselves.
Unquestionably. We serve 138 veterans in one of our larger residences, and they are profoundly troubled. And honestly, the way that they're recruited now, today, since there is no draft.
They being the Army recruiting.
These young men who go in basically see this as their only option to earn a living and then maybe get a free education and all of those things. They come back after several tours of duty, usually, and there's no reentry for them. The VA spends, 2 days debriefing them. Many of them have post-traumatic stress. They've been in a world that doesn't apply really to regular society in any way. They're completely lost. Those of them who do sign up usually, as I said, have nothing, penniless to begin with. A huge number are minority people now.
And they're angry.
And they're angry.
They get angry.
They get angry, absolutely. But you know what? Everyone, when they come in our door, is angry. That's the truth. You can't...
Just some more than others. I mean, the war experience, it's unfathomable. I mean, what they go through you know, and then to just come home.
And boom.
And boom. And expected to act like they weren't there and that something new and different is going to happen.
A country that doesn't know how to say thank you.
No. Well, it's a very dangerous thing not to say thank you to the people that protect and provide your freedom.
And you know, because of the unpopular nature of war and all of that, there isn't much recognition. It's not like guys returning from the Second World War, where all Americans, first
well, there's
of all,
no
were
GI
part
Bill.
Of it.
I mean, there's no.
There's nothing.
Had parties.
Yeah.
You know, it's
and
just
we're celebrated
different.
Beyond that day. I mean, that's what happens to a lot of these.
There
guys.
Must be a theme that they express over and over again.
Oh, of course.
What is that?
They can't believe where they are. They can't believe that people aren't grateful. That they can't believe. Most of the first thing we do is get people on their deserved benefits, their VA benefits. They are dropped basically on the street, and all of them, and they're supposed to fend for themselves in terms of getting their benefits. Well, guess what? It's really hard. And the waiting list is, you know, beyond conception. So they
just
don't...
Just even the paperwork.
So to access it, they need us. We get everybody on what they deserve.
We have a program called Rapid Rehousing, which gets them out of our facility and into an apartment.
Because among this group, many of them can't work because they're not well enough to work.
I've just been asked to. You've got a whole minute left. This is a chance for you to for a message to all those people out there who don't know what you do and why you're doing it. 1 minute. What do you think, Harriet?
Yes.
Your husband is looking right at you.
I think the first thing that I would like to tell people is that human beings' ability to regenerate their lives is unbelievable. And it is the most hopeful thing you could ever be part of. And what we've been privileged to experience with now 22,000 people is that you can make a difference. You can enable people to change their lives and become tax-paying, child-supported members of the community. This is a program that offers opportunity, and people use it.
George MacDonald, Harriet Carr MacDonald, we hope you're able to win the war against America's homeless and give them the hands up that they want.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Joanna Welper is our senior producer, and Doug Doyle is our executive producer. Conrad Sanguinetti is our engineer. If you'd like to listen to any of our other audio biographies, simply Google Conversations with Alan Walper. Until we talk again, I'm Alan Walper.
Special thanks to Phantom Audio, a full-service production studio in New York's Flatiron District. And support for Conversations with Alan Walper has been provided by the Blanche and Irving Laurie Foundation.